Hello, and welcome to this special edition of the Care Matters podcast, recorded live at the University of Sheffield Students' Union and chaired by Dr. Kate Hamlin. This podcast is part of the Economic and Social Research Council's Festival of Social Sciences and is a joint event by the Centre for Care with the Digital Society Network's Digital Inclusion and Ethics Hub. Here, a panel of experts with lived experience discuss AI, sensors, and robots. What's next for social care in the UK?
Hello and welcome to this Festival of Social Sciences event, where we explore everything related to care, the care we give each other, but also the support provided through more formalised provision and policy. In the past, this series has included guests who receive and provide care and support, as well as policymakers and experts from across the world. And we've looked at topics such as how care is often invisible and undervalued, but also specific policies or ways of working that could make a difference to people's lives. This event is also part of the University of Sheffield's Digital Society Network, Digital Inclusion and Ethics Hub. I'm really excited about this podcast, which is going to look specifically at care and technology. We'll be thinking about the kinds of devices that are used in care arrangements and relationships, but also increasingly how online digital provision is being used in adult social care services. Our panellists share their expertise on the reality of technology and care, where they think it might go in the near future. But just to start with a bit of context, technology has been part of care arrangements since, you know, quite some time. If you think about the sort of pendant alarms that have been a core part of a lot of local authority provision since the 1960s, they've been there. Technology has moved on. In the care space, it feels a bit slower. It feels a bit more, if you think about what the advances made in mobile phones, you're not seeing that in the pendant alarm space, perhaps. But in recent years, we've definitely seen a policy focus and attempts to accelerate this through funding opportunities, through other incentives around innovations, around things like robotics and AI. And there's a lot of enthusiasm in government, you know, we've seen the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, Steve Barclay, going to Japan to look at care robotics. We've recently seen Rishi Sunak's enthusiasm for AI. And at the same time, we're seeing a move to online services, the digitalisation of care records, the collection of data. This is all happening at pace. But what we really want to talk about today in this session is what this is like in reality for people who receive care and support, people who provide care and support. Where are we with their technology there? So without further ado, I'd like to introduce my panel. So Katie, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Katie Hurd. I'm from Good Things Foundation. We're the UK's leading digital inclusion charity.
Hi, I'm Laura Sbaffi. I am a senior lecturer at the University of Sheffield working in health informatics and social care.
I'm Madeline Starr, and I'm from Carers UK. Carers UK is a national charity which works to make life better for unpaid carers.
Hi, I'm Caroline. What I work for the National Co-Production Advisory Group, I'm a member of, and I work with Think Local, Act Personal, which is part of, there's so many acronyms. I draw on care and support direct payments.
Thank you. And Caroline, you use technology in your everyday life. Do you want to tell us a bit about that? How it came, how you got it, what did you do use it for?
Okay. I hadn't warned you about this, but it's just occurred to me. Always I cycle every day and I use a pedal assist, which I suppose is technology, isn't it? It works out how much pressure I'm putting on and how much support to give me. But really comes from, I suppose the technology I use apart from a phone and computer is I've got a buddy alarm, which is this thing that looks like a Fitbit. I used to have the pendant citywide alarms from the council, but it really didn't work for me. It only went off if I was next to the receiver box. So it didn't work if I was in the garden or on my trike. And the base was 40 minutes away from my house. So if I'd fallen over and needed help getting up, I'd got to wait 40 minutes. So after falling downstairs 6 months ago, breaking my arm four places, I got this buddy alarm and I claimed for it. I used my direct payment, which is paid for by the council, which is given by the council for me to meet my outcomes and have an ordinary life that you all might experience, but I didn't. So it gives me money to meet my outcomes. So instead of having somebody buddy me and follow me around as like a carer 24/7, I had a buddy alarm, which I claimed for out of my direct payment, which is money I get from the council, which I keep in a separate account, and I have to produce receipts for auditing. So it's all above board. But they let me, and I hate saying they let me because it was perfectly justified, but I had to research it and put my case.
So that's not something that's typically on the council sort of menu of technology. It's something you had to...
Yeah, I had to justify it and almost put my case forward for saving money, basically, because if it hadn't have been for the strong case of saving money, you know, buddy alarm of £99 a month, the having a carer come in costing me, £12 an hour, it's a no-brainer, really. And plus it gave me the independence that I need to live a normal life. Plus, I forgot this. It's got a GPS on it so that when I go out on my trike in the woods, which I do every day with my dog, it provides a location to the five people that I've named as contacts on my buddy alarm. So it'll say Caroline's fallen over in this, you know, square, a location. She needs help, type of thing. So.
And have you had to actually ever activate it?
Yeah. I fell over in the porch, and it just so happens that my neighbour, who is one of my contacts, was taking my dog for a walk on the park behind my house, and he received notification and came back and the GPS even gave the corner of the house I was in where I'd fallen in the porch, and you know, he obviously helped me.
Yeah, sounds like a good example of technology, but it's not quite a robot and it's not quite AI. How would you feel about a care robot? Or
how would I feel? I'm quite a kind of personal, chatty person, and I don't think, I mean, I'm not saying never, but I don't think it would quite cut the biscuit for me. is that the right phrase?
Cut the mustard.
Cut, yeah, that's right. Get it wrong.
I'd rather have a biscuit though.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Now, that's a really great example of, but you did very much have to advocate for this for yourself. And
I do wonder what would happen if the person wasn't capable of thinking, wasn't aware of all these technologies that are available. I mean, would they have been offered like a service provider to come and check on them four times a day and take them to the toilet and that sort of thing, rather than a buddy alarm.
And maybe this is now time to ask other members of the panel as well about some of that, those barriers around information and how people find these technologies. I don't know, Madeline, if you want to reflect on carers and some of the challenges there.
Well, I mean, I have to say I'm really delighted that Caroline is using Buddy, because we help pilot Buddy way back. And what was so lovely about Buddy, do you want to hold it up, Caroline? It's very beautiful.
I broke my wrist, my shoulder, so...
Don't hold it up too much.
I can't hold it up too much.
It's very beautifully designed.
It looks like a Fitbit.
And as Caroline said, it looks like a Fitbit. A pendant alarm doesn't look like a Fitbit. And nor does the nasty white watch with a big red bit in the middle. That doesn't look like a Fitbit either. It looks like what it is. And one of the really great things about Buddy is that it was designed so beautifully. And very deliberately designed so beautifully. So it was highly functional. As you say, you know, it can absolutely show where you are to an eighth of an inch. And it is a very sensitive, if you like, alert system. And I'm absolutely with you. Yes, you'd rather have a buddy than have number one, pendant alarm, which people find very stigmatizing, or indeed someone having to come and check on you instead. But the most important thing about that is that most people don't know about it. So most people won't know that Buddy exists. We did a piece of research in 2013, 10 years ago, when we asked carers about their awareness of the technologies that could support them in their caring role. And we asked the questions. It was a YouGov survey, so it was a representative sample, and we asked tech-savvy people questions. So they were using technology in every area of their lives. You know, sometimes nothing too fancy, but on the whole, they had a mobile phone or smartphone, and they were online banking and shopping. They were doing those things. They were all internet users. When we asked them if they thought about using those technologies, any technology for caring, they said no. So only 3 in 10 people would think about using that. And that's extraordinary. These are people who understand about technology and are using it. So I think barrier number one is that people still don't know about these technologies. And we talk about technology as if it's kind of separated out from our normal lives. I mean, I'm sure that you're a mobile phone user, Caroline, and that the whole range of technologies that you would use, online banking, shopping, and care should just be part and parcel of that, part of our lives, a normal part of our technology-enabled lives. And so knowledge is, I think, a huge barrier. And also, you know, we're bots. I mean, I think it's great, actually, to think about AI and robots. So, I mean, we've delivered digital information services for a long time. It's hugely important to us that we can reach people through digital information and try to give people the information at the earliest possible point. We've developed 2 online platforms, digital platforms that help do that, that can be rolled out by local authorities or by employers. And we created a care coordination app jointly to help connect people who are maybe caring at a distance. So thinking of your family, Laura, in Italy, and can help people participate in care, all of those things. Where next? Well, we'll start using live chat, I think, on the website this year to help to enhance our helpline capability. And then we're going to begin thinking about how we can use AI to introduce the kind of chatbot type facility on the website that enables that to answer far more complex questions without having to go anywhere else. And as for bots, well, you know, Kate, that I'm a fan. So we worked on a pilot with Hampshire County Council on the use of a cobot, which is a cooperative robot, which it was simply something you strapped on, called it an exoskeleton, but that's ever so posh. You strapped it on, and it had electrical stimulators that came down the back of your legs. Sounds sinister, but it wasn't. And it enabled a care worker, initially they trialed it with care workers, it enabled a care worker to pick someone up. So it enhanced their strength. So one person could do a double-handed shift in either a care home or in home care. Well, I mean, that is an absolute no-brainer. It was very well received. And they actually used it in mainstream frontline services for a while. And when they tried it with carers, so we did a pilot on the Isle of Wight, a nice little distinct pilot area, they loved it. They loved it. And I love this response, Caroline, from one lady who said, "Oh my God, if that would mean that I didn't have to sit on the floor with my mum for 4 hours while we were waiting for someone to come and pick her up, that's bloody brilliant," she said. And I can keep it in my cupboard with the Hoover. There we are. So I think there's so much potential. I know Laura and Katie are now going to talk about some of the real barriers to people accessing technology, but we mustn't lose sight of the potential as well. You know, Caroline's using it to great purpose. We know that we can really help to reach people early and provide them with information and support digitally. And then there's some ritzy stuff too that, you know, wow, why not? I would say if we can use these things to help people in their normal lives. But in terms of challenges, over to my colleagues here.
Well, no, I agree with you, Madeline, entirely, that there is so much potential for technologies. And I also agree with the fact that a lot of carers probably are not aware, but there is so much more. I've been working with older unpaid carers, and across the board, the most common sentiment is apprehension. One carer actually described this digitization as the unknown behind the door. So something they don't know how to navigate, they don't know how to interact with for a number of reasons. First of all, some people just don't like technology. They like the human contact. They like to talk to people. They like to be, you know, on the phone with an actual human being at the other end rather than a recorded machine. And some others feel part of this generational gap. So they see all these young people completely accustomed to use all sorts of technologies. And they feel like they lost the train, that they don't belong to this society anymore. They feel left behind. And a lot of them are interested in engaging with technologies. But there is also an element of feeling inadequate. So if someone goes and explains the function of an app to an older person, and then the day after they forget, oh my God, what did they just say? What was that function? What was I supposed to push or press? They feel kind of, diminished in the sense that they don't want to be a burden. They don't want to, keep asking people. So they also have this kind of restraint in using these technologies. Also, okay, suppose they have these technologies. So suppose they have a laptop or they have a smartphone. How to download an app? How to make it function? How to update it? So it's the maintenance of these technologies. So they are not necessarily against the use of technologies, which in principle should be very easy to use. And I'm sure what you've been describing is being designed with carers and older people in mind. But there are so many other services. And again, discussing with these carers, even the simple, setting up of an appointment at the local GP, NHS clinic, it's now happening via mobile phones. So you have to register and you have to fill the online form, and then you receive the message, to which, funnily enough, they cannot reply. So basically, they complain. So people are pushing us to use technology, but it's not equitable because we cannot even reply to that message. So what are we left with? So these are some of the functioning barriers. And then obviously there is the literacy barrier. The fact that people are not, as I was saying before, that they don't feel like they are up to date. And even if they want to be, they have their own personal conditions. Maybe they have cognitive impairments of some kind. So they need constant support, which is not available, unfortunately. not least definitely also the financial problem, because some people, I don't know whether these technical supports, technologies are free to everyone, but probably they're not. And a lot of these elderly people are, you know, on normal state pension, so they sometimes just manage to, you know, be below the threshold for social support. And those are actually the most isolated people, because they don't qualify for financial support. They still need help, and they cannot claim anyone or anything. And it's this never-ending cycle of frustration. And yeah, I'll stop here. I have so much more to say, but so I'm not Katie, go.
It might be a good time to you to bring in Katie and the work that Good Things Foundation to do to mitigate some of these things, maybe it might be nice.
So I think it's important to put some of this in context. So 10 million people in the UK are digitally excluded, but in some way, shape or form. So that might be they can't afford a device to get connected to the internet. It might be that on a monthly basis, they can't afford their mobile phone data package or their broadband data package. It might be that they've not got their skills, or they're scared, or they just don't want to be online. So there's 10 million people. The vast majority of those people are over 65. Lots of younger people, but the vast majority are over 65. Those people that are most likely to be digitally excluded are over 65s, people with health conditions, or people who are disabled. So the very people that we want to use these digital products and services to help them manage their care or manage their health are the ones that are least likely to be able to use it. So putting that in context is really important. And over the last kind of 12 months, we've seen this problem getting worse because of the cost of living crisis. So we've seen more and more people cancelling their broadband package, cancelling their mobile phone package, which means they're digitally excluded. It was great to hear that Caroline had kind of managed to navigate her way to find that kind of the buddy alarm. Brilliant. But how did you find that information? Did you look online? Did somebody tell you?
Yeah, I mean, I had the idea that there was something out there. I don't know how, but I had the idea. And my PA, which is paid for by the council, she did some research for me. Whilst I was there, we decided on the buddy alarm. And there was another one as well, I can't remember its name. And we decided the buddy alarm was more appropriate. And then she then waited. Well, you know, I got in touch with her when the buddy alarm had arrived. She came and set it up for me. And it was that was paid for by the council, but it was only because I kind of was aware and I asked for it and I said, can I pay for it out of my direct payment that the council has given me? So otherwise I would have had to pay for it myself. Exactly.
If you think about how you just find a phone number for somewhere these days, the only way you do that, most of us in this room, is by looking on your phone and searching for it. It is very difficult to find a number for anybody to help you in any other way. So if you don't have a mobile phone or you're not online, you can't do that. And therefore finding out information about the product, services, support that is available to you and allow you to make your own choices about what is right for you is less accessible for you. So we can do all of these amazing things by, you know, providing great quality digital information, chatbots, etc., which help a large number of people, but a large number of people are excluded from that. So one of the things we do at Good Things Foundation is provide free data packages to people who need it, free devices to people who need it, and support people with skills and training. And we do that through a network of community partners. So a trusted face for somebody to go and get help. So your PA would be a prime example of somebody who can help people get online and access the information and the support that they need. And it's only by building those skills and those that confidence and regular reinforcement and somebody to ask the stupid questions of, you know, you showed me yesterday, but I can't remember today. Can I ask you again? Or there's a telephone number that you can call to say, I've switched my device off and I don't know how to switch it on, or my buddy alarm stopped working, or it doesn't connect to the internet anymore. I don't know what I've done. Can you come and help? It's that kind of support that is a fundamental part of making this system work and allowing that technology to move on from the really ugly, horrible kind of red button alarms to something that is more attractive, is smarter, can tell your kind of location down to the tiniest GPS point. You know, that none of that works unless you have the confidence and the skills to operate in the digital world.
And also, the you're fundamentally the infrastructure
exactly.
too. So,
yeah.
I think we need to see. We need to see these things as a utility,
yeah,
and as a public good.
Yeah,
and it should simply be. It's for me, this is a human right.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of access and the support you need,
yeah,
to access and use technology, that this should be available.
Yeah,
and there are, as you say, community facilities that are there to use it. But if we don't crack that
mm-hmm.
infrastructure and fundamental access issue, then all the potential mm-hmm. melts away, because we do know that people are using technology
yeah.
in transformative ways
mm-hmm.
and would not be able to access either the information or the support they receive without them.
Exactly.
So you've got all this, this rich innovation and all this possibility. And then, you've got all the really exciting stuff. But you've got to address the infrastructure.
Yeah. It's got to get to the people who need it, hasn't it?
Fundamental
yeah.
access.
Yeah.
And also attitudes.
Yeah.
And mindset. And those, sometimes they feel insurmountable.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also, it's all going so fast. For a lot of these people, it's so difficult even wanting to catch up. We've been discussing the copper line switch off in December 2025, I think. And it's scaring so many people, because obviously at that point, the standard home telephone won't do anything. They will be disconnected and they will have to engage with a smartphone or some other form of digitized device that they don't have, they don't know how to use, they might not afford. Even if they can afford it, they might be living on their own, going to a shop, and being sold something that is completely inappropriate to them. And then, even if it's appropriate, it's, again, in the maintenance, in the updates. Oh, the screen has gone black. What do I do now? Who do I call? Where do I go? I know that there are a lot of charities, including Carers UK, who offer this. Champions, so the volunteers who become digital champions. The problem is that it's all based on volunteers, and volunteers obviously volunteer their own time when they have it, and when they have it, it might not be at the exact time when the person is in need of a specific support. So there is a lot of need for proper mm-hmm. investment. In training opportunities for these people, a lot of those who are willing to engage with technologies, but also to give space to the others who are, a step behind for a number of reasons, because they don't want to be engaging, because they cannot afford, to be still provided with the same traditional modes of communicating with each other, communicating with doctors, with NHS, instead of being pushed into something so quickly. On a positive note, and then I give I let somebody else speak as well. I'm Italian, I carry on for hours.
It's passion, Laura.
It is passion, yes. But again, from the words of these carers, it's not all bleak, even for the digitally excluded, because a lot of them see this as another revolution. So societies have been through so many revolutions, and the digital one is just the latest. So a lot of people say, if you can hang in there, eventually it will get better, it will improve. But in the meantime, we need some extra support to bridge this you know, gap somehow. And you cannot expect that everyone by December 2025 has the latest version of a smartphone to access all basic information needs.
But the scandal is that we've known this is coming
yes. For
so long and yes. Have done absolutely nothing, really.
Exactly.
Lots of people have done lots of things, including the Good Things Foundation. I mean, and everyone now is, of course, going, oh, my gosh, it's just around the corner. But it wasn't around the corner.
People didn't like mobile phones at first, did they? And I don't know anyone who's not got a mobile phone.
Exactly. We were looking at the data recently about landline usage because we were just interested to see how many people actually didn't ever use a landline, because there will always be somebody. About 3% of the population didn't have a landline. So no matter how hard we try, we're never going to get everybody to adopt the latest technology, no matter how ubiquitous it is. So we have to be designing our products, our services and systems to provide people with multiple ways to access. Yeah. Digital's fantastic. It saves services money. And in the current times when, you know, everybody's budgets are stretched, yeah, I can understand moving services online. It makes things more efficient and, you know, effective. But it excludes more and more people the more you shift. So if it's the only form of access to your product or service, you are losing up to 10 million people, yeah. You know, of not being able to access your products and service. And when you're a health or a care service, that's not right, is it? It's not fair on those people that need you most.
No, I think we need those, you know, those multiple routes
yep.
in.
Yep.
But we also need to do something about the yep. 10 million.
Yep.
So we
Absolutely.
Can't, you know, it's such a huge structural mm-hmm. issue, isn't it? How do we bring the 10 million in, and how do we make it as simple as we possibly can?
Yeah.
And if we look at it in the longer term, in terms of the savings that are made and the essential benefits, that investment in bringing the 10 million in, so you will never bring everyone in.
No.
You never
no, 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 no.
So you will all, you know, we still send, you know, our publications out by paper,
yeah.
And our membership services are largely online, but mm-hmm. we have 1,000 offline members, and we yeah. send them Caring magazine in the post. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be able
yes.
to
exactly,
and that's going to happen for a while until, as Caroline said, there is that shift, and you find, you know, it's almost everyone is using it. But I think, you know, there are some real kind of fundamental questions to ask about who makes the investment and ensuring that mm-hmm. people are included,
yeah.
where that investment sits. Who reaps the benefits of the immense savings that mm-hmm. can be made? Because
yeah.
someone's reaping the benefits
yeah.
of the immense savings that can
exactly.
be made.
Yeah, exactly, because it's a question I had when it was decided that I might save, I don't know, very loosely, £100 a day,
mm,
so
yeah.
10 hours a day, say, who would benefit from that? Would I get 10 hours a day extra to come and have somebody give me a massage and read me a bedtime story? or would it go, you know, would it go back to the service provider?
Cool. That's exactly where it'll go, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it, you know, you know, because it saves them money. But
you know, I mean, I hate to appear tight, but you know, maybe it should go to the council.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah, I mean,
I want some of it.
Yeah, help somebody else.
But
if you don't
I
need
can't
it.
Have that massage myself,
yeah,
Caroline.
Yeah.
It sounds perfect. Mind you, could always have a robot massage.
Mm-hmm.
There we are.
Yeah.
So when you did make the case for the buddy, is that the sort of thing you had to justify to the council, saying, look,
yeah.
it's going to cost me this, but it's going to save you that? So that's the argument you had to
mobilise. That's what I had to do. I had to say, I literally had to do a list of the positives and a list of the negatives. And I think I did a list of costs as well for the direct payments manager to see, you know, it's a no-brainer, really.
I think it's really interesting when, you know, all of the legislation is around well-being and outcomes and person-centred and choice and control, but in reality, it's a very prescribed menu unless you are able to do your research, get your PA to help you do that research, make the case in the language that the local authority want to see, and then you can have the choice.
Yeah, I had to very much, because I kind of sit on things like this, and I know what they're going to ask and what they've got to justify. And it's a bit like I swim every week, and direct payments manager was saying, well, you could go to the council baths. And I was saying, well, I couldn't, because I couldn't cycle that far. If I joined Virgin, I can actually cycle to there. Whereas if I joined Graves, the council one, I would have to get a taxi to there. And so in the end, it would end up costing more than joining the private one. So that's how I had to justify it. So I have to kind of feel a bit tired, a bit robbed, but I have to really beg for, you know, what I'm allowed, really, what I'm entitled to.
And I think this is such a huge part of the problem. You know, we're here talking about some extraordinary potential in terms of technology and innovations that, you know, could support people in new and different ways. And at the same time, you know, access to it is based on a crumbling system that is underfunded and simply doesn't work very well. So on the one hand, you know, we're talking choice and independence and living your best life. And on the other, you're having to go through a 40 question.
Yeah, you know, jump through so many hoops.
Yeah, exactly. In order to get a very simple piece of assistive technology. So it almost, you know, makes a nonsense. Mm. But, you know, there are some real imperatives here, because we're going to, you know, we are going to have, if you like, to understand how we make some of these advances available and how we embrace some of these advances, because we are going to have to work in new and different ways, just because of the shift in population, working age population, numbers of people with need. And we just, you know, we're nowhere near cracking that. I mean, we've been working in this field for quite a long time, and it's, of course, there are advances, and that's hugely encouraging, but, you know, maybe not as many as we would have expected to see by now, where there were some fundamentally quite straightforward technologies, like, you know, fall detectors, environmental monitoring that can really help people live longer in their homes, which we, I think, would have expected to see embedded in mainstream services by now, and they're not. And we're still talking about actually some pretty basic stuff, and fundamentally we're still talking about access to the internet. Yeah. And helping people to get online.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's schizophrenic, really, isn't it?
I think one of the biggest strides that we've seen in the technology that can help people manage their care at home are devices like smart speakers. So many families have now bought smart speakers for their homes and for the people, their loved ones that live on their own. And as we all saw on the kind of, I think it was Amazon Alexa advert with the blind lady, I think she was using the device to tell her what the weather was like and, you know, help her kind of set out her day. I think there is real potential in those devices that are sitting in everybody's home, but there is a lot of worry about, from many people, about what that is monitoring and what that is doing in your home. So there is a real fear for many people that are digitally excluded about the safety and the security of their information and their data. And if they open themselves up to that online world, what does that mean for them in terms of losing their ownership of them and potentially being scammed, et cetera, et cetera. When the landline system gets switched off, who are all those scammers and how are all those scammers going to get in touch with the people that they're already trying to contact through the landline mechanism? So they are going to need to move on to something else. So we're going to have to think about whether the smart speaker is another route into somebody's home or whether they might be able to do that. But the potential of having emergency response in every room in the house, where you shout out the name of your device and say, call for help, and it can contact somebody who will come and get you, that is a phenomenal leap forward. But not every home has it. Does every care home have it in every single room? You know, that would be a simple technology that could provide access to lots of other things as well as that emergency support. So, you know, thinking about that is really important.
Yeah, but that fear of, you know, regarding safety and not knowing what happens to your information, your data, that's something that emerges time and time with carers. Because nowadays, everything, you apply for a service, you buy a product, everything involves providing all sorts of information. We have carers also commenting on the amount of cameras around streets, monitoring everything and everyone. What happens to that information? They are really terrified by scams to the point that even they withdraw from genuine offers, fearing that those are scams. So they miss out on services because they don't want to be the victims of something illicit. And what Carolyn was saying is exactly also something else that transpires. For everything, everything is so difficult to obtain. Everything needs to be justified. Questions after questions, and a lot of them are probably even irrelevant to the actual use of a product or a service. And it's another barrier. So we are dealing with some people who have mental conditions, disabilities, and it's a deterrent having to go through something so complicated, particularly if you are on your own, is daunting. And some people just give up without even trying. And that is something else that, who is responsible for this? Developers, the government? And things should be just made simpler. So at least, like you said, we will never have everyone on board. It's just not possible. But there are so many groups within these 10 millions that can be helped in so many ways. And we, like you said, are not doing enough. We are not doing anything.
I think that takes me to a nice point to actually come to each of you and ask, magic wand time, what's the one change you would advocate to enable technologies to be really life enhancing in the world of social care? So maybe I'll start with Katie.
So what I would really like is for the stuff that we have to work well, you know? So any of the devices that many of us take for granted, actually we open up to everybody who could benefit from them when we provide them with the training and the support to have access to the things that they need. A smartphone is a huge amount of power in the palm of your hand, processing power that we never even imagined 50 years ago, that kind of technology in your hand. So the power is there for us to do something really amazing with that. I think what I would also like to see is that we put ownership of people's information about their health in the hands of the people who it's about, so that we start to see, you know, them understanding their condition better and them being able to share that information with the people that need it to be able to help them make the right decisions about them. So the fear about sharing information about myself is much reduced, and you're able to say, oh, you've seen that now, I'm going to shut down your access, you don't need it anymore, you know, I've finished dealing with you, but I'm going to open it up to somebody else who can really benefit from seeing that data and work out how they can help me. So They're the improvements I'd like to see.
Fabulous. Laura?
I'm, first of all, agreeing completely with Katie. I'm going a bit on the technical. So we're discussing AI, and with other colleagues from the university, I work on natural language processing. And I've been working also with minority groups in Sheffield. One of the barriers they found, apart from the digital literacy in general, but also the language barriers, and obviously I also have an accent, and I firsthand experienced that. You talk to a machine online on the phone, they don't recognize your accent. But you are there repeating the same thing over and over, and they come up with a completely different option. And it's, again, frustrating, humiliating. And so this natural language processing is just a subcategory of AI, which is used to, you know, basically to process, analyze speech and also written text. And if the training data sets would be more comprehensive to understand, recognize accents, it would be obviously more inclusive for patients, for people in general, but would also, I think, save a lot of money to the NHS, to the actual healthcare system in general, because basically this system will start storing relevant information. They will start basically interpreting relevant information. And again, considering how, you know, desperate the situation, the financial situation of the NHS is, this could be something to look into. So, yeah. All right, done my pitch.
Fabulous.
If I just let you know, Laura, that my husband is from Yorkshire and it doesn't understand him either. So just need to let you know that. So it doesn't understand regional accents either. I'm with Katie. I want what we have to work, because actually we have an absolute wealth of stuff, and that is from the simplest of technologies to the most complex, including, you know, complex AI, including robotics where it, you know, where it works well. I think we've got a lot of stuff. A lot of investment has gone into development. We never ever mainstream anything. You know, we suffer from, you know, pilot after pilot after pathfinder, trailblazer, whatever we want to call them, and it never, you know, we don't stick at it. We don't enable it to scale, and we don't make it accessible. So there's something about making it all work, and then there's something for me about curation. We have to let people know what they can have, and we don't. And that needs to be a mainstream service, and it needs to be provided. I mean, it is so interesting. We did a series of focus groups to follow up that famous 2013 study, which found that no one really understood care technologies. And in the group, when you told them about things like falls detectors, they were, oh my God, you know, people looking after fabulously frail parents who didn't know you could have a buddy. Caroline didn't know you could have that fabulous stuff. So that was actually really exciting. But when we asked where they would want to find out about these things, what do you think they said? They said, I want to find out from my GP, because that's where I go. Now, that makes us, of course, all despair, because it's incredibly hard, actually, making your GP tell you anything, however. So we've got to have that in the system. Somebody knows about it, and someone can curate. They can tell people what might help and you know, what's available. And mm-hmm. I'm with you, Katie, the power of the smartphone. Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. We didn't ever think we would have that. And then, you know, some of the extraordinary developments we're seeing have to be made accessible. We have to tell people about them and help them to understand it.
Mm-hmm. Caroline, I'm going to give you the final word and the final magic wand.
What was the question again?
It's magic wand time. What do you think is the big, if you could wish for any change that would enable people to have technologies that enhance their lives, what do you think is the key thing?
Well, I know this isn't really... It leads to technology, but it's if people could have an Angela, a PA, to come in and show them how to do it, like human language, and be an actual person, come into their home and say, you want to press this button and this button in order to get a speaker to listen to you. And also, I kind of, the confidentiality of it all, because really weird, yesterday I was on the phone to my friend and I was talking about when I used to go, I don't know, when I went canoeing once, and that, you know,
and I haven't done it since, but I was just talking about it. And the next thing, I'd got loads of canoeing adventure holidays on my Facebook. And I was just like, this is so weird. And so I do wonder who's listening. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, thank you. I think that's trust is a really big one, but also people, I think, would be a really big takeaway, that often when we focus too much on the whizzy bits of kit, we forget about the importance of people. You know, these whizzy bits of kit are supposed to be connecting us to people, but they also need people to make them actually work and care. And I think that's a really nice way to round off and close the podcast. And thank you all so much for your fabulous discussion.
Thank you. Thank you. For enabling us all.
Thanks for listening. For more information, please visit www.centreforcare.ac.uk.